Well, I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be here and how thrilled I am and sort of just really I don't know, for loss of words, I just say really jazzed about this summit subject. So again, the subject is the divine light and life of religion, and something very important in my life, always has been from the time I was a child, but now I want to share some things with you. So let me, and again, these are based on, I'm trying to keep up with the admitting people to the class, to this gathering. But let me just start again. Again, I refer to the words of Hazrat Inayat Khan, and they're sort of interwoven with my own commentary. So that's what I'll be sharing today. Divine life has a certain capability to give life, and it gives life as various sacred teachings to us, the children of the earth. In the ancient Sanskrit language, the word for religion is dharma, which means duty. And you know what? I have to just pause for a minute because I realize I've updated this and I am not looking at the updated version, I don't think. No, I am. So excuse me. It's just the way things are. So, as I said, in the ancient Sanskrit teachings and the language, religion is referred to as dharma. But dharma also means duty. So, in that context, we can think that our everyday life and the duties that we perform can be given that kind of attention as if it is our dharma practice. In Buddhism, we call it our dharma practice. So, it becomes our religion or our sacred task, we could say. Now, Inayat Khan teaches us that everyone is born into a life as a pupil. I mean, we learn from our mothers and fathers, we learn our language and our habits and what's hot, what's cold, you know, different things. And every soul is born a believer. We have to be, or we wouldn't be able to function in this world. But he goes on to say something like this, that it's only afterwards that we turn into unbelievers. And when contemplating this, I thought, it's really true, because I've seen people become unbelievers through the process of their education. Perhaps it's in studies of science or math or philosophy, and these things become taken very literally. And therefore, people begin to think that religion or spirituality is illogical. It couldn't possibly be. There are no such things as miracles. There's no such thing as enlightenment or illumination, but I personally find that no farther from the truth. I would ask the question of those, why let these studies and our logic blunt the connection to the divine? I know none of you do this, but perhaps someone looking at this in the future will, it'll ring true. I know all of you are tuned in. But instead, gaining all there is from our studies and bringing it into the light of the divine. You know, it's like all of a sudden it's there, it's in this room. Can we put the spotlight on it and illuminate it? And in order to do that, we start to see things in a new light and we start to realize that even these disciplines themselves, these studies, are a miracle in and of themselves, and their development is also a miracle in and of itself, to give these gifts of knowledge in that form to the world. Okay, religions are many and they're different from one another. We acknowledge that. But only in form. For example, water is one and the same form, but it has the ability to take the form of its container. And so water can become you know, it can become held in a vase, in a bowl, in a pitcher, and when it's frozen, it becomes ice. And so it is with religion. The essential truth is one, but the aspects are different, the way it manifests. For example, the same formless essence of God is expressed in scriptures. I'm going to let Evelyn in the scriptures of Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and for that matter, all spiritual paths, whether we know them or not. It's that essence of the divine that's taking form in those, and appropriately so. The essence of these are to impart and to recognize the inner truth. And those of us that recognize it, we have no argument. But those that don't, they'll fight about it, and they'll argue about it, trying to convince one of their other point of view. But rather, the point is to try to harmonize the people of all religions. Here's an example. I was telling someone this, and they really delighted in it. When Anayat Khan came in through Ellis Island, he was asked, "What race are you?" And his reply was, "The human race." And when he was asked, "What religion are you?" his reply was, "All religions." So this is a very broad perspective, and he believed that and lived that, and he taught us that too. I also have experienced that, for example, and some of you have met her. I have a dear friend who is now no longer on the earth, but very alive. I hear her all the time. She was considered a Hindu saint, and she was a world-class musician as well, and her name was Sri Karuna Mahima. And she was a lifelong student of the body of teachings of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. And she was one of the principal trustees of these teachings. And yet, when you looked on her bookshelf, she had all of Anayat Khan's books. She had holy scriptures from other, profound teachers. And when I traveled with her in India, we went to visit other holy teachers from other traditions. And she was so respectful, and she was treated them like they were her guru. And so this was a very big perspective. Another example is, and I know I've told you this, is that my Tibetan Buddhist teacher had sent me to a place to go and do some prayers in the caves of Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava. It was a very special lake there. That's a whole other story and a whole other teaching. But on the way, I was traveling with two Buddhist monks who were, to protect me and help me get to where I needed to go. But I asked to stop at the temple complex where a huge Shiva statue was in the middle of a lake and all these little temples devoted to various Hindu gods. And I went to pay my respects. I made offerings and I paid my respects. And my monk friend said, "You shouldn't do that. That's like breaking your Buddhist vows." And I said, "I don't think so. I don't believe that to be true, but I'm going to go ask my teacher." And that was a big thing for me, because I thought, if he tells me you have broken your vows, then I knew I would have to leave him, because it's so contrary to what I feel in my inner core being. And his response was, "There's only one true primordial wisdom, and it manifests in many names and forms." There you have it. The light is in all religions. And I thought that just made so much sense to me. And I said to him, "You are a Sufi too, Rinpoche." And he nodded his head. But the point is to emphasize that there's one truth, but there are many vessels, many containers. And that's appropriate, because did the different prophets have come at the different times within the different cultures? They have their own way of teaching according to cultural customs. And then this way, knowledge is passed along. So when directed by a new spiritual inspiration, and this is now Anayat Khan speaking, because he made a break from traditional Sufism, and he talked about it as this new dispensation, this new movement. So he says, when directed by the new spiritual inspiration, law, morals, education, and all these areas of life come to renewed life and illuminated understanding. people mostly think that the spiritual message must be something concrete and definite and in the way of doctrines and principles. But this is a human tendency to limit things. God doesn't belong to human nature, although it may be part of that. It's divine nature, and divine nature is unlimited. And it's just unlimited life itself and beyond conception. It is to be realized through a direct experience, not through concepts. In the scriptures, and I'm talking about the Holy Bible of Matthew, Mark, and John, we find chronicled Jesus warns that his new message of grace and the kingdom of God cannot be contained within the rigid, outdated structure of the legalistic Jewish traditions. Jesus uses the metaphor that new wine requires flexible new wineskins, meaning that a dry flask that's rigid can't adapt to this new wine, and new wine has an effervescent quality to it. And so therefore it has gases and would just burst that wineskin. So we have to think about that. Sometimes we have to have new containers. So the meaning is that we need to open our hearts, and I know I'm preaching to the converted here, but I'll say it anyway. The meaning is that we open our hearts and minds to accommodate its growth and its birth and its growth, preventing the ruin of both the message and the recipient by rigidity. Yeah. Well, like the sun, the divine message does not teach anything, but in its light we learn to know all things. The sun does not cultivate the ground, nor does it sow the seed, but it helps the plant to grow and to flower and to bear fruit. And when we allow the light of God to shine in us and through us, we evolve a new understanding, and that understanding is revealed and experienced. Now, if you allow me, I'm going to just say a few words about my personal experience regarding Sufism. This has nothing to do with what we had talked about before the last class, and that's a whole other subject. But what happened for me is when I met the Sufi message, it spoke to my heart, and it struck a note and a promise that somehow I would be guided to the fulfillment of the purpose of my own life, and that that would be revealed to me. And this continues. It's an ever unfolding process. The Sufi message was and is for me a blessing stream that opened my heart to love and peace and joy. The Sufi message gave me strength during the most difficult of times and challenges, and there have been those, as there are in all of our lives. This is inevitable. But those challenges, I made myself think, don't let them harden you. Let them burst you wide open like a chicken coming out of an egg, you know, or a crack in a wall where the light can come through. I have purposefully reminded myself of that during those difficult times. And the Sufi message has helped me. It gave me the confidence to lead a more inclusive life, not to block myself, not to have fear, but to approach people openly, lovingly, and try to forgive as much as I can, and just realize people are doing the best they can. And believe me, I live with those challenges in my personal life. This is a revelatory path where one can understand more and more that the inner life is reflected in the outer life, and that our outer life is reflected in our inner life. It's like this synergy, and it's a built-in great biofeedback system. The Sufi path gave me courage to live through and also rise above the natural ebbs and flow of life, and I like to think of it as surfing on the waves of life. I'm just trying to be buoyant and go with it. I think they say going with the flow. Now, I know we started late, and I would like someone to do a time check for me. I would like to know how much more time I have. Say? Anyone?
Another 15 minutes.
Okay, I think I'm good. I'm moving ahead just a little bit. So my Sufi studies revealed to me that what is hidden in different sects and different religions, not sects, but S-E-C-T-S, forgive my pronunciation. And again, this is an ongoing revelatory process. In other words, truth and wisdom can never be studied, and it really never can be taught nor learned. It's to be touched. It's to be awakened to. It is to be realized. Something, by the grace of God, helps us with that. And if we have a good teacher, they can help us with it. And I've had fabulous and amazing teachers. Thank you, God. It is to be realized through the enfoldment of our heart and our soul. And you know, I just have to keep saying this. It can't be taught, it can't be learned, but it can be observed. I remember learning so many things by observing my teachers and watching them carefully. And just like we can't taste food from a recipe, we really can't get it from just reading books. There's something else that happens in our understanding and opens, and some of that comes through the transmission of the teacher in good and bad ways. Sometimes they can be very hard teachings. So a few weeks ago at Mass, the priest said this, and I loved it. I clung to it, and I went to him afterwards. It's like, let me get this straight, because I knew I wanted to share this. He said, and you can say, I'm going to say the heart of Jesus, but you could say the heart of anything, Buddhism, Judaism, you know, it could be the heart of Buddha, it could be the heart of Muhammad, it could be the heart of, you know, Rama, whatever that is for you, just let that be. But he said, because it was in that context, the heart of Jesus is the destination to God, and the Beatitudes are the GPS to guide us there. And I loved that metaphor. It's like, there's the map, there's the destination, but the Beatitudes are our guides, the GPS. The priest crafted his sermon from the readings of the Holy Bible, and this is from Matthew. And he chronicles the Jesus's incredible Sermon on the Mount. And as you know, the Sermon on the Mount came after Jesus was baptized by John the Baptizer, and Jesus began to travel and teach and live his ministry in Galilee. And this is Jesus's longest and most popular sermon, and it includes the Lord's Prayer as well as the Beatitudes. The focus on the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes in particular, as the priest said, is the GPS towards a life pleasing to God, whatever form that takes, okay, and living and realizing the characteristics of spiritual discipleship. So, what are we a disciple of, and to whom? Of course, the conventional GPS meaning is global positioning system, but in the context of today, I'd like us to think of GPS as God positioning system. So it's like reorient it. Let it reorient us. And listen to these words of Jesus, and I will try to give a pithy one-word explanation after each, which may be helpful. And I'm taking these as my own practice, just to study them deeply every day. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This is humility. Blessed are those that mourn, for they will be comforted. This is sympathy. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. This is gentleness. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. This is integrity. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. This is reciprocity. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. This is innocence. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. This is harmony, harmonizing. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This is patience. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil things against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you, This is forbearance. So these are beautiful qualities, and we can think of those and how we can integrate them in our lives. Hazaret Anayat Khan, in his, there's a body of teachings, and he, first of all, his words, he says, prayer is the greatest virtue and the only way to be free from all sin, or we could say misguidedness or misappropriateness or whatever else. We know if we don't like that word sin, but we're missing the mark. You know, it keeps us on the path. In Buddhism, mantra is used. As you know, mantra is a word or sound that's repeated to aid in concentration and meditation. And it stills the mind, gives us that mind that jumps around. It helps to still the mind by concentrating on the sound. And the same could be said of any prayer or word to direct our thoughts. Could be using the breath, concentrating on the breath. So some of you might know this book, and if you don't, you might want to get it because it's beautiful. It's called Glimpse After Glimpse. It's written by Sogyal Rinpoche. Sogyal Rinpoche did an interpretation. I think the title of that book is Tibetan Book of the Living and the Dead. And he's a very beautiful person and just filled with joy in life. I've had the great opportunity to just sort of randomly meet him and have conversations with him. But I like this description. He says, a meditation technique used a great deal in Tibetan Buddhism is uniting the mind with the sound of the mantra. The definition of mantra is that which protects the mind. So when the mind is spinning off in all its various interpretations, still it with a word, with a prayer. And he goes on to say, Sogyal Rinpoche does, that which protects the mind from negativity and which protects you from your own mind is mantra. We need to be protected from our own mind at times. So the Beatitudes of Jesus powerfully demonstrate the power of the word. And when concentrated upon, these words become integrated into us as our thoughts. And our thoughts over time become our reality. I think I mentioned this in our last conversation. You know, my mother's doctor was very clear. Be optimistic about your prognosis with cancer. Denial is fine. I wouldn't take that away from anyone. And he said, keep your thoughts very positive because form follows thought. And he said, I'm saying this as a medical person. We see that the way people think, their body will follow. So keep that in mind. This is a man of science saying this. So like the Beatitudes, in Sufism, there's a body of teachings called the Mysticism of Sound. And in there is a chapter, and it's called The Power of the Word. And this chapter comprises a series of phrases by Hazaret Anayat Khan that I kind of think are like the Beatitudes, but different. They're very personal because they were given to students individually, but they're also universal. And so some of them sound like a petition or a request of God, and some of them are like affirmations. And so I'm only going to read out of these 26, five of them. I'll point out whether I consider it an affirmation or a request. I think you'll hear the same. And for those in our study circle, and all of you, maybe there's something that speaks to you that you'd like to pick up and use as when the mind starts to go into fear, bring it back with the mantra or the prayer. When the mind gets angry, bring it back with the mantra and prayer. When the mind's confused, bring it back with mantra and prayer. So here we go. Again, there's 26. I'll read five. This one's an affirmation. I am well and happy in the life and light of God. This would be a petition. Grant me, Lord, thy wisdom, joy, and peace. This one is an affirmation. Someone out there, I know you know this, is for you. My body, heart, and soul radiate the healing spirit of God. Another one as an affirmation. My life is changing and taking a better turn. And that, let's see, I don't think I had it. Yeah, one more. This would be a petition. Make my heart thy divine temple. Make thy heart thy divine temple. Time, Joe? How much more time do I have?
It's 11:30.
Okay. Well, let me just kind of get to the chase. I think most of you were here some time ago. It was maybe last year, could have been the year before, when we did the Universal Worship Service. We lighted candles from the different scriptures, and we read from the different scriptures. And the person performing that is indeed a minister. We go through education and study all the main world religions and then some. In Sufism, we're called not a minister, or we are called reverend, but there's also a term that an icon gave us. It's called chiragh. It means light bearer, so bearing the light. At the end of the Universal Worship Service, there is this benediction that's given. And for me, it is so beautiful. I really wanted to share it in closing our time together. I'm going to say it, it's in its entirety, and then slowly one line at a time, and there's only like four or five lines, so we're almost done here. May the blessings of God rest upon you. May God's peace abide with you. May God's presence illuminate your heart now and forevermore. May the blessings of God rest upon you. May God's peace abide in you. May God's presence illuminate your heart now and forevermore. And now I've asked Kyle to prepare a musical offering. It's called The Alchemy of Love by Rumi. Really, his words are as living today as they were in the 13th century. He was a Persian mystic poet, and his poems were love songs to God. And so I wanted to share this one with you. Thank you, Kyle.
You come to us from another world. From beyond the stars and void of space. Transcendent, pure, of unimaginable beauty. Bringing with you the essence of love. You transform all who are touched by you. Mundane concerns, troubles and sorrows dissolve in your presence. Bringing joy to ruler and ruled, to peasant and king. You bewilder us with your grace. All evils transform into goodness. You are the master alchemist. You light the fire of love in earth and sky, in heart and soul of every being. Through your loving existence and non-existence march, All opposites unite. All that is profane becomes sacred again.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria. What a wonderful essence of everything universal oneness, I believe, stands for. You know, the poetry, the insights, the ideas, the beingness of how you do it is such a blessing. Thank you.
Thank you so much.